to go. You know, you've never known anything but here. So if here gets weird and crazy and loony enough, it just might be that you don't want to be here anymore. So maybe that's what some of this is about. I don't know. There are probably 150 possibilities. But Psalms 46. And I don't know about y'all, but Psalms has been a comfort through the last 4 or 5 months, and I found it to be rich and thought-provoking. Usually, you know, guys, you pick up a commentary on Psalms and you're going to get devotional material. And devotional material is really good because for us, when it's applied right, it's still doctrinally true for us. But again, I've tried to emphasize the fact that, you know, need to put yourself back in this, and that these are, on top of being inspirational to us, these things are doctrinal truths for somebody else, Israel in particular. And so much of this looks forward, not just backward, not just history, but forward to the future and prophecy. Look in 46:1. We've spent a couple weeks in the first verse just dealing with God being our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And that's what you want, is a very present help in trouble. The three Hebrew children in the fire found that, you know, as bad a scenario as you can imagine, they found that God was a very present help, because they found the Son of God down there already, right? Now, folks, that's what you want when you go to the hospital, or when you're stricken with your final disease. You know, you want the Lord to be there, a very present help in trouble. Look at verse 2. That being said, therefore will not we fear. So that ties in with Sunday morning Sunday school and, you know, not being given a spirit of fear, but a power, love, and a sound mind. And, of course, again, you have to place yourself today where, you know, the panicodemic has taken us and run with us. I said the other day, you know, it's like all the pigs are on the top of the hill, dug in like at a track meet, ready to go just as soon as somebody says boo, and down they go, down the hill they go into the lake, you know. So that's what America's like, that's what the world's like. They're just waiting for the next big boo, and it'll be something else. But verse 2, therefore will not we fear. Now again, you'll see in a second, this "we" is technically Israel. Don't worry about applying it to you. It does apply to you. It applies to you just like 2 Timothy 2 says. 2 Timothy 1 says. But keep in mind where you are. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Well, that sure sounds like allegorical, metaphorical stuff. Until you read Revelation 8. And then you realize that these folks aren't just talking about, you know, metaphorically, you know, when you have a bad medical test come back, you know, it's not talking about that. It applies to that. Don't worry. I mean, applying it devotionally like that's a grand thing. But Revelation chapter 8, remember that these things are going to happen literally, prophetically in the future. Revelation chapter 8, and go down to verse 8, Revelation 8, 8. The second angel sounded. Of course, you're in the middle of the great tribulation, in the middle of the trumpets. And it says, the second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. Well, that's what it said would happen. It said, therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. That's what happened. He's talking about a literal event for the future. He's talking about Israel standing in the tribulation, seeing these things happen, and saying, because he is our refuge and strength, therefore will not we fear. Which is a remarkable thing, right? It says in verse 2, therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Now, there's lots of verses we could run along this line. Look in Isaiah 24 real fast. Isaiah 24. And one passage after another talks about the earth being shattered and broken and the great tribulation, mountains flying around and all these things. In fact, at some point when the second coming of Christ comes, the men of the land beg the rocks and mountains to fall upon them to hide them from the face of the Lamb. But Isaiah chapter 24, and if you will, go down to verse 20. I get a little weary sometimes. You know, when you pick up a commentary, usually what you're going to get, you're going to get watered down devotional material, and that's all fine. For instance, in my Bible here, you know, this is a Holman. It's what I've used for years and years for study Bible, but the words are inspired, but the headings aren't. And for instance, Psalm 46:1, before that, it's the note is confidence in the church of God. Well, I mean, we can apply it to ourselves, the church of God, but this has nothing to do with the church of God. And that's what I would like for, that's what I would like to see more Bible believers even get a hold of, is the fact that, you know, there's a historical application and a prophetic application, doctrinal. And then there's also the devotional application, which we're also used to. And that's how everybody now teaches the Bible in the main. When you open up and listen to most radio preachers, most of them are going to preach every single passage devotionally. They're going to take Psalms and apply it to us, which is fine. But I wonder if they know that it applies to somebody else in a much different fashion. So you have here in 46:2, therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed. So Israel, literally, though the earth be removed in the tribulation, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, they're going to see that thing in Revelation happen. It's happened more than once. Did I ever read Isaiah 24? I didn't, did I? it's because I was, doing what I always do. 24:19. I think we saw this recently. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. The transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it. It shall fall and not rise again. The context shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high. Second coming of Christ. Right? But it says, though the earth be removed, in Psalm 46:2. And here you have in verse 20 of Isaiah 24, the earth being removed. The Bible's a remarkable book. God inspired the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek. And then when the translators translated, they used one word out of Hebrew in one place and one word out of Greek in the other. So the two words match in English. You think that's an accident? It's not an accident. He did it so you would have those two put together, so that you could put the two together and it makes some sense. Look in Psalm 46, verse 2. Though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. Now again, these mountains shaking, just since you're in Isaiah 13, again and again, you could go to, we could literally run dozens of verses on just the earth shaking and trembling. It's part of the prophetic formula. But the sun will withdraw our shining, the moon will be turned to blood, the earth is clean dissolved, it's utterly broken, etc., etc. That's all prophetically for the great tribulation, foreseeing the second coming of Christ. Isaiah chapter 13, and go down to verse 13, talking about the earth shaking, and the mountains shaking. Isaiah 13:13. Therefore I will shake the heavens and the earth. I will remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger, second coming of Christ. And so that's what you see in 46:3. The mountain shall shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. And as we've said all through Psalms, almost always, can't think of an exception, when you see the word Selah, you're going to find the second advent of Christ directly related to it. It just seems to hang out around those things. Probably not an accident, you know what I'm saying? Look, if you will, in Joel 3, I'm still looking at the earth shaking a little bit. I'm looking a little bit at the earth shaking, or rather something like that. Joel 3. And so for that reason, we're warned, you know, by the Lord in Matthew 24 that there'll be an increase of earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars and all those things. I would remind you that before those things, I mean, granted, the earthquakes may be increasing, but it's also because we're detecting more. And the wars are increasing, but it's also because now we know that there's a war in some little podunk country, you know, on the other side of the world that the two tribes are fighting. We now know that what Paul, the apostle of the Gentiles, says for the church is that the signs of Christ's coming, and I'm talking there about the rapture, are inward depravity, the inward depravity of man. Perilous times shall come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, disobedient to parents, etc., etc. The men are just wicked inside. Look, I don't have any idea. You know, they've been adding up earthquakes for all these years, and they're increasing. It's just anytime. It's just around the corner. Well, it may be 7 years after we get out of here before those earthquakes finally come to fruition. Thing is, you're getting out early. And what you need to be looking at is the depravity you see around you, society, culture falling apart. And even here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, man alive, has it just come apart at the seams. You just wonder what's next because it gets weirder and weirder. Daniel was telling me that he talked to a National Guardsman. We didn't hear about this on the news. He talked to a National Guardsman that was in the riots down in Minneapolis, breaking them up. And he said that they stood and watched one guy execute another. Cold blood. You didn't hear about that. See, they're a bunch of lying scumbags. Just, if you weren't here for Sunday morning, the media is a bunch of lying scumbags. And they're not telling you what you need to know, and they're feeding you full of a bunch of other baloney. And so why wouldn't they report that, you know, this peaceful protest that nevertheless resorted to arson? Why wouldn't they report that there was a definite, just an execution? Not police officers, not National Guardsmen, the protesters. What's that about? Anyway, well, how did I get off on that? Joel 3? Yeah, okay. That didn't help. Okay, Joel 3:16. Here's what I wanted, though. I was saying, you know, just keep in mind the next time you find somebody who's busy counting earthquakes and, you know, the number of stars that are falling and, you know, wars and rumors of wars and all these things, just remember that what Paul said was that the depravity that we're going to know that the time is near for us is the depravity of man inside. And those lists of how bad man can get, because that's what we're looking for. But for the Great Tribulation, verse 16 again, the earth is going to tremble, that's for sure. The Lord also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth shall shake. There's that shaking. It happens over and over again. But the Lord will be the hope of his people, the strength of the children of Israel. Just one more on the shaking. I know you're convinced already, but find Haggai just a little bit further to the right. Haggai 2. This is one of the passages in Handel's Messiah, if you're familiar. Verse 2:6, Haggai. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come and shall fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. But the earth shakes and trembles, and the Lord comes back in fury. Back to Psalms 46. So you find at the end of verse 3, the Selah there again, designating that you have second coming material, second advent material, within spitting distance at least. Verse 4, there is a river the streams whereof make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. Now, we did this sometime in the recent future. I can't remember if I did it here or at Brother Lambert's. But go back to Ezekiel 47. What's it talking about? Ezekiel 47. Well, this is what it's talking about. It says, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. The city of God is Jerusalem in the millennium, right? And their waters thereof, verse 4. There is a river, the streams thereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. What's it talking about? Well, in Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 1, I know I covered this. I'm not sure if it was with you or what. But verse 1, afterward he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. Now there you have the house of God, and there you have the Lamb's throne. And it says that waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. And so you got a river springing up from underneath the throne, the threshold of the house, and it flows eastward. For the front forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under, from the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. Now, this is a huge river. It becomes a huge river. Verse 2, then brought me he out of the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way without unto the other gate by the way that looketh eastward. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits. So 1,500 feet. And he brought me through the waters, and the waters were at the ankles. So 1,500 feet of just wading waters to the ankle. And then he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knee. So there's another 1,500 feet. And now the waters are to the knee. So it's a wide river that's gradually getting deeper. By the time this thing is over, there's several thousand cubits that he leads this guy out into. And finally, verse 5, it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim, and a river that could not be passed over. He said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, the bank of the river were very many trees on one side and on the other side. And then he said to me, these waters issue out toward the east country and go down into the desert and go into the sea, which being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. What's he talking about? Well, the river flows east and west until it gets to the Jordan Valley, and then it turns south and flows down into the Dead Sea. Now, why does it flow east and west? Look in Zechariah, next to last book in the Old Testament. Did we cover this? Okay, I don't know, because I did it recently. It must have been at Brother Lambert's. I'm not sure. Zechariah chapter 14. And what makes that possible in the millennium, because right now there's not a way for it to flow east and west from Jerusalem, which is a little ways from the Jordan River Valley. But there will be a new valley spring forth. Verse 4, 14:4 of Zechariah. Talking about the Lord Jesus Christ, the day of the Lord, verse 1. Verse 4, his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. This is Jesus Christ, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. There shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half of it toward the south. There's your valley. And so suddenly when Christ touches down on the Mount of Olives, there's a great quake, and there's this valley that opens up east and west where his feet landed. And now there's a valley by which waters can flow out of the Lord's temple from beneath the threshold of the house and flow east and west to the Jordan River, take a right and flow on down to the Dead Sea, which heals all those waters, which are dead as dead can be. But that land comes back to flowing life in the millennium. The curse is removed and those waters heal it. So it's kind of cool to see those things in the scriptures. Look in Psalms back to Psalms and verse 4. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. This city of God is not Rome, as Augustine said. He said the city of God was Rome. That's one of the stupidest things anybody ever said. It is Jerusalem. It's millennial Jerusalem. It's the city of God. Notice that this is repeated in 48:1. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. Well, that's Jerusalem. Now, you know, you can heavenize it, devotionalize it, and make it New Jerusalem, but it's really talking about millennial Jerusalem here. Look at just one more. Look in Psalm 87:3. It's referred to over and over. Jerusalem is the city of God. Go tell that to a Muslim. Watch him throw a cog. Psalms 87, verse 3. Glorious things of thee are spoken, O city of God, Selah. Notice Selah. Glorious things are spoken of thee, O city of God. We sing that song. That is talking about Jerusalem. Back to Psalms 46. There is a river, verse 4, or the streams there whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. It is in that day a holy place. It doesn't seem very holy now. It's just all talk. The Muslims consider it holy. The Pope considers it holy. The Eastern Orthodox consider it holy, and so on and so forth. And it's all just talk. It's just all something to fight over. But in that day, it'll be holy. And as I showed you sometime recently, there'll be a day in the millennium that the Canaanite can no longer even enter into the house of God. But it says there in verse 4, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. And then it says, God is in the midst of thee. She's or in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. God is in the midst of her in the millennium. When Christ came, he was Emmanuel, God with us. Where Christ dwells in the millennium is where God is. And that's going to be Jerusalem. You can typify it and make it work as New Jerusalem in some ways, but if you will, once again, Isaiah chapter 12, I just want to verify, look, your Bible bears constant testimony, but the problem is some of the parts of the Bible we're exploring, nobody even knows about anymore. They've been so objectified with their Greek and their Hebrew, and the language has all been changed, and all the wording's been flip-flopped and flip-doodled so that Bibles don't even make sense anymore. And your Bible's not like that. Isaiah chapter 12, and go down, if you will, to verse 6, Isaiah 12, 6, where it says, cry out and shout, thou inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel in the midst of thee. See, God's in the midst of her, literally dwelling in the city. It's Jesus Christ's throne. He's going to dwell there. He's going to live there. Look, if you will, to Ezekiel. Back to Ezekiel for a few passages. Ezekiel 43. Now, we saw the river in 47. But in 43, this is where you're now dealing with a rebuilt temple. Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even to the gate that looketh toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. And his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. It was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kebar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. And I heard him speaking unto me out of the house, and the man stood by me, and he said to me, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither shall they. So this is where he lives. Look in Ezekiel 42, just nearby. Start with verse 1. Then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looketh toward the east, and it was shut. Then said the Lord unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it. He came in through that gate. And that's still in the future, but it's going to happen. And I like it when the Bible starts fitting together in pieces. You know, Ezekiel used to be this monstrous mystery. You know, it's like, you know, just this endless mystery. I don't know what he's talking about, you know. But, you know, you get a couple places to hang your toe in, and it starts to make some sense. And pretty soon you have more than one string of things that you kind of understand there. That's all you do with the Bible. You lay precept upon precept, things you do understand, you add to that, and then you add to that, and pretty soon you have a longer string, and pretty soon you understand more than you ever thought you might when you first started, and the book was such a mystery to you. You know what I'm saying? But here is God dwelling literally in Jerusalem. I'm looking for another passage here, one that I want you to see. Let's go back to Joel 3 real fast. Joel 3, and notice verse 17. So shall ye know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, there shall no strangers pass through her anymore. Verse 21, for I will cleanse their blood that I have not cleansed, for the Lord dwelleth in Zion. Your Savior, the Son of God, God manifest in the flesh, is going to stand in Jerusalem. That city that, you know, the old part is just kind of rubble now. And he's going to stand in that city and rule and reign there. It's a blessing. Anyway, verse 5 of Psalm 46, 5, God is in the midst of her. You see what he did there? He projected you forward in time. He's not there now, not like this, but he is there. He's projected you into the future. You're now standing in the millennium seeing this happen. And you need to realize that's what he did. Verse 5, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. Now, why would he say that? Because the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. Now, what's that all about? Well, what that's all about, if you go back to Psalms, most of you memorize the first few verses of Psalms 2 for sure. This can be taken two ways. First of all, it's primarily this. Psalms 2 and verse 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, now you think that's happening now, but wait. Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. Well, we're not under bands and cords of Jesus Christ now. Right? If it is, it's of love. It's not real bands and cords. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said unto me, thou art my son. This day have I begotten thee. Okay, so the heathen rage. What are they raging about? They're raging because they've now, for 1,000 years, been ruled over by Jesus Christ in the millennium. And they're fed up with it. The devil's been let out of his, been loosed from his bonds, and he's come out to raise up some trouble. And so you read then, Revelation 20. Now you've been moved forward through the entire end of the millennium. Revelation 20, verse 7, and when the 1,000 years were expired, that's where we get millennium from. You have 1,000 years occur in this chapter, 6 times, I believe. That's how, and we call it a millennium because it's 1,000 years, but that's how you know there's 1,000-year literal reign of Christ. There's no such thing as amillennial. There's no such thing as postmillennial. None of that stuff works. It's all premillennial. And so verse 7, and when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan's been bound in hell, and Christ has reigned without interference for 1,000 years, and the curse has not been on the earth. Everything is wonderful, except for the fact that there's still a bunch of men that are wicked. And it says in verse 7, and Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Now, this is not Armageddon. This is 1,000 years after Armageddon. Verse 9, and they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, Jerusalem. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Very anticlimactic. All this drama, and then, and it's over. But it's amazing that the Lord would allow Satan loose again. And it's amazing that, you know, we keep looking forward to the rapture because in our minds, you know, in our time frames, we think, man, when the rapture comes, this battle's over. You know, I'm done with my flesh. And it's true. It's true. But the rest of the world's not. Because you're the bride of Christ, and, you know, Israel goes into the millennium, and there's a bunch of other nations in the millennium who, by the way, grow to resent the rod of iron that, you know, Jesus Christ bears, and they've been now under it for 1,000 years. You know, we haven't been a country that long, and apparently this Mod Pod cupcake generation has grown tired of things like liberty and freedom. And so now they're desirous of a Marxist regime. You know, Black Lives Matter, that's all that is. It's just a Marxist regime where, you know, if they don't like you and you buck them, you're going to get your head blown off in the street. Okay? And so they get fed up with it. Well, it takes them 1,000 years, but by the thousand years are over, they're fed up with Jesus Christ's rod of iron. And so he looses Satan, and Satan goes and stirs the pot once again. And there's this massive gathering outside Jerusalem for the rebellion of the nations, only it's just not very dramatic because it's just, boom, it's just over. Burns them up. But it doesn't stop with that burning. Notice verse 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. So notice, he went from hell, was loosed out of hell, and now he's pitched into the lake of fire. And then I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. There was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. They were judged every man according to their works, and death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. So the great rebellion rises. The Lord takes a deep breath and goes, and burns them up. But with the burning, notice, if you will, one other connected verse here, 2 Peter chapter 3. Looks to me like when the fire comes out of his mouth and burns up the adversaries, that it burns up the whole kit and caboodle. 2 Peter chapter 3. And verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise. The elements, and it's never spoken like this before, the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. See, the elements themselves, there will no longer be hydrogen and carbon and copper and zinc. The very elements themselves will melt. The whole, everything that the physical creation is built upon shall melt. I think it starts with the Lord issuing forth fire at the end of the millennium to burn up the adversaries, and then the elements themselves melt, and then the dead, small and greater, standing there before God on nothing. And there they get judged, and from there, they're just pitched into the lake of fire. But again, this testimony of this thing where the elements in verse 10 shall melt with a fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, completely dissolved, like Alka-Seltzer, only all the way down to the elements themselves. There are no longer elements. There are just, you know, whether or not they're even atoms anymore, who knows. But verse 11, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. So he's before all things, and by him all things consist. And so, you know, when man wants to build a hydrogen bomb or a fission bomb, you know, he plays with a heavy uranium and plutonium and stuff like that. Takes him a long time to get enough of it together where it will reach a critical mass, and I'm not a nuclear scientist, so I don't understand all that. But in the end, it's just taking elements and shuffling them and putting them together so that they can make a bomb. Well, one day, everything's a bomb. The carbon in that pulpit wood is a bomb. The chair you're sitting on, including the upholstery, kablooey, blow off your hind end if you were here. Because it's just nuclear. The elements themselves will melt with fervent heat. So I like thinking about that. Anyway, back to Psalms. We'll see what we can find a place to start. Stop here. So verse 6, the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. Now this works for the second advent too. I think the first thing you should see is that it is definitely at the end of the millennium, but also it works for the second advent of Christ, that is Armageddon as well, because we know that the heavens shake, the earth moves, and fire is involved. The fire that comes out, you know, the voice of the Lord. Look in Isaiah real fast, Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah 30, I'll let y'all go in a second. Isaiah 30, verse 30. Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard and shall show the lighting down of his arm and the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones. For through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrian, that's the Antichrist, be beaten down, which smote with a rod. And so it's the voice of the Lord, it's God speaking. And so it says in verse 6, the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved, he uttered his voice, the earth melted. Look, if you will, in Isaiah 64. Isaiah chapter 64. And verse 1. Oh, that thou wouldst rend of the heavens, that thou wouldst come down, that the mountains might flow down at thy presence. They're melted. And when the melting fire burneth, the fire causeth the waters to boil. Make thy name known to thine adversaries, that the nations may tremble at thy presence. When thou didst terrible things which we looked not for, which camest down, thou camest down, the mountains flowed down at thy presence. It's things melting down. But that happens at the second coming as well, just not as fully. All right, we're going to find a place to stop here. Verse 6, the heathen raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. With who? Well, he's with us. He'll never leave us nor forsake us. Just don't lose the point that he's talking specifically, prophetically to Israel. It's true for you too now. We know that. But he's talking to Israel prophetically. The Lord is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Like the psalm started. Selah. There it is again. Second coming. Right? Come, behold the works of the Lord. What desolations he hath made in the earth. Saying, come, look at this earth that's sitting here now after the tribulation. Look what God did. He ripped it apart. It is just a desolation. Look what God did. Glory to God. Right? All right. Any questions or comments here? Yes, sir, Brother.